Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you all for joining. We're now going to begin the second semester of summer 2021 Contemporary Halacha. We're going to go through a number of shiurim. We're going to start with Shechita, presented by Rabbi Avidan Elkin. First of all, it's important to know that every Jew is kosher to Shecht. Even women, Mikra Hadin, except Ramah says that women shouldn't because they might faint. And we have to know, very importantly, the five psulim of what constitutes shechita. Of course, it's not mefurish in the Torah, but we have a halacha moshe misina that shechita involves five psulim. Remember, the acronym is shochad ra, shehia, chalada, drisa or hadrasa, hagrama, and ikur. So ikur with an ayin. So what's shehia? Shehia is pausing in the midst of your shechita. Once you start a shechita, you have to pick it up. The Mishnah says if you pick it up long enough to pick up the animal, knock it back down and shecht it for that specific animal, each animal has its own time frame, that would be pasul. And all the pauses that you pause would add up in a shechita, would add up to that time. That's the halacha. The Mishnah says, shachanach pasul. Nevertheless, halacha l'maisa, the Ramah is more machmir. It says any shehiyah at all could be problematic because, hey, ogbel chabashan, could do those three actions really, really fast. So therefore, we have to be, I don't know, like wired for Ogbel Chabashan, and therefore, we have to avoid any Shia whatsoever. So that we are machmir for, except with cattle, which are difficult to shecht. They're very expensive. So we will tolerate a short Shia. That's the Chumrah of the Ramah. The Sfaradim have two competing minhagim of what that time frame is of to pick up the animal, throw it down, and shecht it. So one is about 10 seconds, and the other says it's as long as it takes you to recite that Mishnah that says how long you have to shecht, which is about 7 seconds. Okay, that would be two opinions with among the Sfaradim, how long the Shia you could have. That was Shia. Let's talk about Chalada. Chalada, which is similar to the word chulda, like a weasel, is stabbing between the tisimana, meaning you're supposed to take the blade and put it down on top of the simanim. If you stab between the simanim, or you stab through the skin, which is, or you do a cutting that starts underneath the like covered over by the wool, something that involves stabbing or coming in from underneath, not just a smooth slice on top, that would be chalada. That is the reason why, if you ever looked at a chalif, a shochet's knife, the end is not pointy like many of the knives that you have in your kitchen. Like a dagger, it doesn't have a dagger point. To the contrary, it has a flat edge. It's like a rectangle blade so that you can never stab or point or poke and therefore never violate chalada, which is the second of the five. The third one is hadrasa. Doreis is to trample, to apply downward pressure. When a shechita is done, it's only done through the gravity, pulling down the blade. You just go back and forth, back and forth. You don't push down. And the sharpness of the blade is what's supposed to cut. If you chop, like you're chopping an onion, like you're chopping like a samurai, chops, or a guillotine where it's a chopping action where there's the pressure coming down, that would be the psul of hadrasa. The fourth psul is hagrama. That's the resh for hagrama, for shochad ra. Hagrama basically means that it's the right part of the neck. It's not too high, it's not too low. Basically, the entire neck is really kosher for shechita. There's a very, very, very top part of the neck is possible, the very bottom where the lungs meet the basically as low as the lungs meeting the bronchi. It's pretty high. It's pretty low down. So it's pretty high up and pretty low down. So you pretty much have a very, very wide span to aim towards. So you shouldn't mess up your hagrama. When you want to think of hagrama, just think of giraffes. Giraffes, you have a lot of room to do it. And giraffes, you cannot do hagrama. So giraffes have a G for gimel, hagrama. So giraffes, you're never going to do hagrama because they have big necks. You're never going to mess that up. Finally, ikur. Ikur is to uproot. You dislocated the simanim. Now, there are two, I don't know if you mentioned it this year, but that could mean one of two things. Rashi understands that the uprooting or the ripping is that the knife has a blemish. The knife is serrated. The knife has a pegima, and therefore it's not just going to slice, it will tear, it will rip, it will be oker, and that would make an avela. The Rambam says, no, it's not that the knife has a blemish. What it means is that you're pulling out the roots. The neck was sort of pulled out. The simanim were pulled out before you did the shechita. They weren't in the proper position. They were uprooted. The simanim, meaning the kan and the veshet, were uprooted when you did your shechita. That's going to be the psul. Those are the five psulim of nevela. Those are the five requirements of shechita, and therefore those not fulfilling those five requirements create a nevela. And then, of course, you have the 18 simanim of treifa, which is the Mishnah in the beginning, the third parak, I think, of Chulin, Eila Treifa, 34th parak of Chulin, whatever the treifas are, which you don't have to remember all 18 treifas. Hold on, Tanya, I just have to move really fast, and then we'll see what else we get. Well, you do shechita, you have to make sure when it comes to a behema, you have to do two simanim. When you have an oaf, you only have to do one simon. However, you only have to do rov of the two simanim for a behema and rov of the one simon for an oaf. However, the riff is machmir that when it comes to an oaf, even though you only have to do one simon, the riff is machmir to try to do both. When it comes to a behema and you want to do rov of both, the Rama says not just have 51%, the Rama is machmir, you should also try to have a rov nikar. That's a little bit more than just the beginning. Now, when it comes to treifas, 18 treifas that an animal that the Mishnah says is a treifa, we really are not concerned. Like, why should you assume it has any of the treifa? Why should you assume there's a punctured, meningenes, brain membrane? Like, why should you assume there's a punctured this or that? Except in the very singular case where we do have a miyud hamatsui, and that's holes in the lungs. And therefore, you do have to check the lungs for that single treifas. What do you want to check for? Well, you want to check for sirchas. Sircha is like a lace, a string that's caused by some kind of, possibly caused by a hole. There was a puncture in the lungs, and the trefa is not the sircha. The trefa is the punctured lung. The lung, or the puncture of the lining of the lung. If there's a punctured lung, that is a considered trefa. And what happens when a lung is punctured? Well, oftentimes there's some scar tissue that develops on the surface of the lung and some fibrous tissue that connects two things, looks like a little bit like a mucus spreading from one piece to another piece. That could be an indication that there was something underneath. So here we're going to have Machlokas Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam as to what that sircha indicates, what that little bit of lesion, that adhesion, that additional piece that's sticking out from the lung, what does that show? So Rashi says, Ein sircha below nekev. That means if there's a sircha, you could bet your bottom dollar there was a hole underneath, and this is the scar tissue that's trying to grow on top of it, and therefore this animal must have had a hole, and therefore it's a treifa. So if that's the case, then anything that has a sircha will be a treifa, and that's going to be more machmir most of the time, except in very specific cases where certain situations where certain sirchas, like if there are different lobes, for example, the liver has four lobes, lungs have different lobes. So if it's between from lobe to lobe, that might not be considered a trefa, a sircha that's a trefa. But most of the time, a sircha demonstrates that there was a hole underneath it. And if there's a hole underneath it, it obviously is a trefa and not kosher. However, Rabbeinu Tam understands that situation in a more lenient way and says that you could basically. And this is the leniency that the Rama gives you, which is perhaps one of the biggest leniencies that the Rama offers in all of Shulchan Aruch, to be honest, that even though it has sirchas and the Sfaradim, the Shulchan Aruch, might say that this is a trefa d'oraisa, don't get so nervous. A little trefa d'oraisa, Timtum Halev is not so terrible. I don't mean it like that. The Rama says, no, you could still blow up the lung and see maybe, it doesn't mean definitely that there's a trefa. It means that you have to check to see maybe there will be a treifa, and you have to do a bedika, blow up the lungs to see if it would be able to hold air, and maybe it will be a treifa, maybe not, and check what kind of sircha it is. Maybe it's not. Maybe there's not too much of a sircha. Maybe it's a sircha that could be there. These are different shitas that leniencies that the Rama offers. Maybe it's a little bit of a sircha that could easily be, that could just sort of slip off, or if you push it gently, that you could mush it up with your hand. They were not worried about that kind of sircha, even though according to Rashi, that would be a sircha d'oraisa and trefa d'oraisa. And therefore, because of these various leniencies that the Rama had, and these came head to head with the Sfaradim, who we at one point lived together with, So we got this idea of this thing called glatt kosher, glatt, which means smooth, which theoretically should mean without lesions. So chalak beit Yosef, chalak, which is Hebrew for glatt, really would be a smooth lung. But the problem is there are not so many animals that have really smooth lungs without any lesions. That would actually be totally fine according to the Beis Yosef. So we have something that's a little bit lower level, which we call glatt. Glatt doesn't really mean smooth. It means that there are only a few lesions, and they're only small, and they're easily detached. This is the Rama in Yerodea Lamites Yud Gimel, if you want to see what he writes, the coolest that he has there. But it's not clear exactly what the word glatt means from a halachic perspective. Obviously, the reason why kosher meat is so expensive is because you have to cover up for all the non-kosher animals, and you have to cover up for the backsides of the animals that have all the non-kosher parts, the chelev, the gitanasha that we that Ashkenazim don't like cleaning out, and that even Sfarim have to clean out part of it. It's interesting to know that the only time that we're makel, let's talk about nikur. Nikur means uprooting or digging out, removing whatever is usher from the dead animal. So what are the things that have to be removed? Well, first of all, you have to uproot the arteries. Why is that so? Because there are different types of dam in the Torah, of course. There's dam that leaves during shchita. That's dam hanefesh. That's nisakaris. There's dam be'en, wherever there's blood that's pooled, like inside a heart, like inside an artery or vein. That's a nisulav of malchus. And then there's dam evarim, the dam that's actually that you get inside the roast beef that's absorbed into the limb. And there it depends. If it's pirish mimakomo, it's lav. If it's low pirish, then it's going to be mutter. And when we salt our meat, it's to get rid of that third type, that dam evarim. So moving back 30 seconds to the dam be'en, the blood that's pooled in the veins, the arteries, the heart, and locations like that that have pools of blood, that's why you have to make certain cuts and in various veins and arteries to allow the blood to drain, to get rid of the dam. So you have to open up the heart. You have to also pierce the lungs because blood could pool there. The liver has to also be cut as like an X or like a chassis of to drain the blood there. Aside from the dam that you have to take care of, you also have to get rid of the gitanasha. And the Gitanasha Drabbanan that's in the back two legs of the behema, of a chayan of behema. The Shuman Hagid, which is Drabbanan, also the branches of the Gid need to be removed. And of course, there's Chelev that needs to be removed. These are all different things that I'm listing off that need to be removed when a person does Nikur for an animal. Primarily, most of these things are the back side, the hindquarters, they call it. A number of nerves have to be removed. And also the Matnos Kahuna, which are parts of the lower leg. Machlok is exactly if it's the bottom two or exactly how to measure the bottom part of the leg. The Zrol, Lechayim, and Keva. The Keva, which is one of the stomachs, and the Lechayim, which is the part of the cheek and lower jaw, that would all be required to be removed during Nikur. That was the Shir on Shechita. Let's now move. Yes, Tani, what was your question?
Can you say what the first of the simar that disqualifies that make an avail of it? I missed that.
Yeah, Shehiyah, which is pausing during the Shechita.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay, next move to the next Shehiyah. The next Shehiyah will be the halachas of Chol HaMoed that Rabbi Adler presented. So number one, it's important to remember that in Pirkei Avos, the Mishnah says that HaMevaze Es HaMoedos Ein Lo Chelek LeOlam Haba. What's Mevaze Es HaMoedos? It doesn't say Mechalel, so it can't be referring to Malacha. It's talking about not giving it the proper covet. For example, to not eat properly, not drink properly, maybe not wear clothing that is a little bit nicer than a weekday clothing. That's mevaza es hamodos. That's an important thing to... Now let's talk about the malacha on Chol Moed. The main question is malacha on Chol Moed midaraisa or is it midarabanan? So there's a Gemara Chagiga that has five different drushas, believe it or not, all from Psukim or drushes from Psukim that clearly are mashma that it's a din d'oraisa on five counts. I think Rabbi Adler this year didn't have enough time to go through them, but if you go through the Gemara Chagiga, you'll see five different drushes. The problem is, Tosa says that all of these drushes, believe it or not, they're every last one of them must be only an asmachta. And he proves it from the following. Tosa says, first of all, how come Wina, three questions. How come there are only four aliyahs on Chol Moed and not five like Yontif? It must be that it's not an Isra Malacha like Yontif. Number two, how in the world could you have a chiluk between Dover HaAved, Dvar Mitzvah? How could you have leniencies for Chol Moed of the type that could only be leniencies that are Midrabanan, created Midrabanan? The Svara of a Dover HaAved or a Dvar Mitzvah is not a Svara Midaraisa. And finally, based on Yerushalmi, the Yerushalmi says the following lashon. Listen to my second word. Klum Osru, meaning Chazal. Malacha Elalecha Velumo Torah. That's lashon of the Yerushalmi relating to Chol HaMoed. So lashon of Osru clearly indicates that it's an Iser Mide only Rabbanan. So we have a Machlokas Rishonim based on the two ways to the simple reading of the Gemara is that it's the Raisa. Rabbi Natan proves from these 3 points it must only be the Rabbanan. But believe it or not, there is a third Shita. The third Shita would be something like the Sefer Achim. Sefer Achim says, of course, Isra Malacha is Daraisa. Oh, so how could you have these distinctions like Dabar Aved and Dabar Mitzvah? Because Masran HaKosav LaChachamim. In other words, Chachamim were tasked by the Torah to define what is to be considered Malacha in regards to Chol HaMoed. That was a test that was given, and that was an authority that was handed to Chacham to be Koveya, what is considered Malacha for Chol HaMoed. Now, there are a number of nafkaminas whether Malacha is Darais Darabanan. First of all, could you ask a guy to do Malacha on Chol HaMoed if there's a Safek? Maybe it should tefillin on Chol HaMoed should depend. If there's an Isra Malacha Darais, then maybe you won't wear tefillin. If Midarais you can do Malacha, so it's like a weekday, maybe you should be wearing tefillin. Okay, that's as far as is it Darais or Darabanan. Let's go to one of the clearly when we talk about the idea of this that we said in the Sefer HaChinuch of Masna Kaz LaChachamim, what is the mode that the Chachamim are working on? They're working within the parameters of trying to set up a day that is conducive to learning Torah and to being misanig. The having simcha and learning Torah. Those are obviously the factors, the type of day that the Chachamim are going to try to generate through the Isra Malacha. And therefore, if there's a Malacha that will not allow you to enjoy, for example, you can't go to Hershey Park, so they'll say, go to Hershey Park, we want you to be happy. Or if there's a Malacha that will make you despondent, you'll be so sad, your house is leaking, you're going to running a gigantic expense, the plumber is going to get, bill is going to get more and more expensive, you can get sad. So you're not, you know, the Chacham are not generating a day of Simcha for you. So that's why they gave you those dispensations. Okay, now what kind of Malachas are, first of all, before we get to the Malachas, it's important to know that Mukta does not apply in Chol HaMoed. All the Gzeros, you know, Shemayal, and not to climb a tree, not to climb on an animal, not to go swimming, those also don't apply by Malachas. What are the five leniencies that we have when it comes to the Isra Malacha of Chol HaMoed? So number one, we'll talk about four. Davar HaAved, Davar that's Tzarech Moed, a Poel, She'en Lo Mayochal, and number four, Tzarech Rabim. Let's talk about each one of those. Davar HaAved, Let's talk first about Tzarech Rabim. I'm sorry, Tzarech HaMoed. Tzarech HaMoed means I need to go to Hershey Park, or I need to cook, shop for food. So when it comes to Tzarech HaMoed, then number one, you have to know that there's a limitation that it's only Tzarech Hedyot that we permit. A Maisa Uman would be prohibited. So Maisa Hedyot would be permitted at Tzarech HaMoed, not a Maisa Uman. So that means you would not be able to bring your car to the mechanic. This does happen. In any shul, you can always have somebody who needs to do car work around this time of the year, and they wait for Chol HaMoed to do it. Wrong, because since mechanic work is Maisa Uman, even if you need your car to go to Hershey Park, that will be also, because Tzarech HaMoed is not permitted to do a Maisa Uman, only Maisa Hedyot. If it's just a matter of changing a tire to get to Hershey Park, that will be permitted, because changing a tire is a Maisa Hedyot. Another halacha is that if you do a Maisa Hedyot, it should be done b'tzina, because not everybody will realize that it's the Tzarech HaMoed. So those are two halachas regarding Tzarech HaMoed. When we say that you're only allowed to do a Ma'aseh Hedyot, not a Ma'aseh Uman, that limitation does not apply to food. When it comes to food, Tzarech Ochal Nefesh, thicker things, there we allow even a Maisa Uman. So for example, if you're a pastry chef or a fancy restaurant cook, you're allowed to make a really, really fancy dish of food because Tzarechei Moed is permitted even for a Maisa Uman when it comes to Ochel Nefesh. We could extend the Mishnah in Moed Katan extends that idea of Ochel Nefesh not only to food, but even to anything that relates to the body. So for example, makeup. The Mishnah in Moed Katan says that a woman is allowed to get fancy, fancy makeup, even a professional makeup, even most Maisa Uman makeup, because that's like Ochel Nefesh. It's a Tzarech HaGuf. Anything that's a Tzarech HaGuf, you're allowed to do even a Maisa Uman. If that's the case, well, let's think about the following. What about you get locked out of your house? You need to hire a locksmith. Well, you need to get into your house. Or there are not enough bathrooms in your house, so you need to hire a plumber. But that's a Maisa Uman. It's a Maisa Uman to do the plumbing or the locksmithing. So we could argue that to not be able to have enough toilets in your house or not to have enough or not to be able to get into your house because you're locked out, that would affect your physical body. That would be like Ochel Nefesh. It's an extension of Ochel Nefesh. It's a Tzorach HaGuf. And therefore, a Maisa Uman would be permitted in that situation. Another application of this Shaila of Maisa Uman versus Maisa Hadid is what is the status of a Polaroid camera photo? Where again, you're creating a beautiful picture, but it's being done by a person who's a hetios. So this is machlokes. Do we look at it as the act that you're doing is very simple? The result of what comes out seems professional. Similarly, when you print something from a printer, you know, to press the print button is easy. You press Control P, but the thing that comes out looks formatted, looks neat, looks nice, looks professional. So that was machlokes. Rav Moshe, who was Mekel, and Rav Yaakov, who thought that since it had a professional touch, it looks like a Maisa Uman, it should consider a Maisa Uman, and would not be permitted even L'Tzorech HaMoed. Okay. While we're talking about Tzorech HaMoed, what would be the status of an appointment? So obviously, if it's an appointment because you have a headache, because you're sick on Yontif, of course, that's Tzorech HaMoed. But what happens if it's... What happens if it's for like a doctor's checkup, a dentist checkup? So here, it seems that a doctor's checkup should possibly be usher. Ramosha seems to say that. And a dentist just checkup should seem to be usher because it's not a tzorach hayantif and it's probably a maisa, it could be a maisa uman. Of course, if you worry that something's going to get worse, that would be mutter. But nevertheless, there are poskim who do allow going to the doctor and dentist even for routine visits, but based on a heter in the Shulchan Aruch that you're allowed. There's no issur of medication, refuah on yontif on Chol Moed. So that's one issue. Now let's go to the next leniency for Chol Moed, and that is the heter of davar ha'aved. Even though we said that for tzarech yontif, ma'isumen zaser. For David HaAved, if you're calling the plumber, not just because one of the toilets are broken, but it's leaking and it's causing a hole in the roof or in the ceiling and it's going to cause more and more and more damage, that's the David HaAved, then you're allowed to call the plumber, not for Tzorech Yontif, because that might not be, but you're permitted because of David HaAved. David HaAved is mutter even a Maisa Uman. So if something is breaking, if you don't take your car to the mechanic in the next 24 hours, it will self-implode. I don't know, it'll explode. Something crazy will happen to it. If you don't get it quickly to the mechanic, then you could take it to the mechanic. If you just need to fix it, then you're not allowed to, because that would be. So what we're saying is that a Maisa Uman is not mutter. A Maisa Uman is aser, but Tzorchei Moed, but a Maisa Uman is mutter for the heter of Davar HaAved. Even though we do permit Davar HaAved, we permit it even for a Maisa Uman, there are two limitations. Number one, it can't be an excessive tircha. And number two, you can't be mechavein malach to lemoi. You can't specifically schedule. Let's say you have to take care of it, there's a big leak in your roof. You have to take care of it at some point in the next 2 months. So you tell yourself, I'm off from work during Pesach and a Chol Moed. I'll take care of it on Pesach. It's a davar ha'aved, right? Sorry. If you, even though it's a davar ha'aved, if you're mechavein malach to lemoi, that's aser. Okay. let's talk about the next heter. The next heter that we had was Tzorchei Rabim. So Tzorchei Rabim does not mean that anything that's for the shul doesn't mean that you could install, you know, build a shul or build a yeshiva on Chol HaMoed. The Mishnah that permits it clarifies that this is only, then the Ramah passes, these are only for things that relate to Tzorchei HaGuf. Like there's a hole in the floor somebody could fall into. The mikvah has a problem. The toilets in the bathroom, in the shul bathroom, and the school bathroom aren't working. So something that relates to the Tzorchei HaGuf, that's going to have the heter of Tzorchei Rabim. But just building shuls and schools, that is not permitted on Chol HaMoed. What's the svar b'chla, why there is a heter of Tzorchei Rabim? There's a beautiful svar of the Ravid that says that since no one is responsible for the tzibur, it's a communal thing. It's a single individual, so no one ever is going to want to take off from work and do what needs to be done because it's not my shul, it's not your shul, it's no one's shul. Oh, but if we're off from work anyway, that's a time that people will be willing to do things for the community because they're not working anyway. So that's why Chazal allowed these tzorchei rabim to be done on Chol HaMoed, even if you're mechave malach to l'moed, if it's for tzorchei rabim. Okay, that's all we're going to talk about for the any questions on Hilchos Chol HaMoed. Okay, let's now jump to Rabbi Reese's shiur on Beis Din and Arkos. One second, can you get me a cup of water? Okay, so the Torah says, "Eilam mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem." Lifnehem means you have to bring your court cases in front of a Beis Din. And not in front of, well, two things. Not in front of Ovdei Avodah Zarah, and also not in front of secular courts, even if they're not necessarily Ovdei Avodah Zarah. There are two aspects that we have to know. Number one, there are two problems with Goyish courts. Number one is Miyakir Shem Alilim. You're turning to a different, you're turning to the Goyim, to the Avodah Zarah, to provide your, to fill that which you don't have, to fill your lack. And second of all, is a Chil Hashem, because it's almost as though Torah can't take care of this. That's called Meir Miyad B'Torah's Moshe. You're saying Torah can't take care of this. I need to find some other way to deal with our system. Now, the Tashbetz points out, this is not just Avodah Zarah. There's all Goyim, all secular courts will have this problem of our cause. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam Shehakol Nehyeh B'Dvaro. Okay. So even if you would have a Jewish court that says we're going to use Gentile law, that would be a problem because you're Meir Miyad B'Torah's Moshe. And even on the other hand, if you have a secular court that says we're going to follow Torah law, that would be a problem because you're Miyakir Shem Alilehem. You're going to their courts. So either way, you have to have both of those aspects. Now, the Ramban points out that there's two things learned from this part. I'm sorry, Chazal points out that there are two things learned from this part. Lefneihem, v'lefneihem, akum, you're not allowed to bring, you must bring your court case in front of the Sanhedrin, the Beis Din, v'lo lefneihem akum, not in front of Goyim. And the second drasha is v'lo lefneihem hediotos, even if they're Jewish, not in front of hediotos. The Ramban says that even though both of these are Yisroim d'oraisa learned from this pasuk, there's a difference between them. Because if you appear in front of hediotos, Jewish hediotos, there you can accept, both parties have the right to accept upon themselves the ruling of the Hediotos Jews. However, if both parties are willing to go to a secular court, to Goyim, that will be not okay. That will be considered Masa Mashikas Batorah. Even if both parties agree, then it will still be also. So even if two parties agree to go to Beis Din, it will still be an Isser De'oraisa. If two parties agree to go to Hediotos, that would be Mutter, says the Ramban, since both parties agree. What happens if you have a contract? The two Jews have a contract that says it's going to go to the court. So, of course, it's usher to follow that contract. And more, furthermore, the Shulchan Aruch says that that contract it will not even be binding because it's not being masne on a davar shebe mamon, which two Jews can be masne. Rather, it's a tanai on a davar iser. So, therefore, it will be considered masne amasha kasabat Torah. Okay. So, let's say we're going to go to Beis Din. You and I are going to go to Beis Din. But we want Beis Din to follow a certain specific secular law. So are we allowed to do that? So this is going to be Machlokas, the Sma, the Taz. The Sma says it's okay. The Taz says it's Aser. Maybe we'll come back to that a little bit later. One area where this comes up is a very source of much of what are the parameters of a Jewish court following some secular law or some areas of secular law. Comes up in the prenups when a person says, I'm going to, ask the Bezdin to please follow whatever law is governing in New York State and California. This is based on a Rashba that's very complicated, and I'll show you why. The Rashba was talking about a story where a woman got a very wonderful dowry from her father, and she and her child died. So according to Allah, who yashes her? Her husband, of course, but they had a very short marriage, and this son-in-law is going to walk away with a gigantic amount of wealth from and start a whole new family with the wealth from his father-in-law. So the father-in-law took him to court or to Basin, I don't remember who it was, maybe even to Basin, saying, well, we all know that the minhag around here is that you, even though normally the husband yashes his wife according to Torah law, but in this case, we should follow the minhag in this area is that you give the money back to the father, the woman's father, because why should he lose all of his wealth to the son-in-law that he had for a year or two and lose it from his family? This son-in-law is going to take it and go build a new family with the father-in-law who's no longer his father-in-law's wealth. So in that story, the Rashba is seemingly soser himself. On one hand, he says, yeah, we should follow umdina of what people assume when they get married, so maybe it should go back to the father. Then the Rashba switches gears and says, but you're not allowed to copy the goyim and the fnei v'lo the fnei hadyotos, and you can't uproot hilchos yerusha. You're going to just cross the laws of the Torah out if you don't follow the halacha. And then you don't need Torah anymore if you're just going to make up your own halachas and follow whatever the secular court says. And then he says, but if it's to one Jew with another Jew, you could be mechayev yourself however you want. So there seems to be different points in this Rashba. And basically we come out with many different mahalchim of to what extent we could introduce a secular law or a secular minhag into the psak of a Beis Din. And that is, I'm going to present a number of ways of Mahalchim in this Rashba to understand how a secular law could be inserted into a Jewish Beis Din. The Beis Yosef says that what the Rashba's problem is that I don't want to have Dayone Goyim. I don't want judges who are Goyim, but the Dinim that you want to introduce, if you want to have a Din from the secular community, whatever this is considered used in the secular community, and that's a normal way of working, that's fine as long as the judges are Jewish. That's what the if both parties agree to it, first and second law, that the Beis Yosef says would be okay. Others say, Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, for example, says you're not allowed to be okay an entire body of law. For example, to say we want to follow Hilchos Yerusha of the Goyim. If you want to say there's a very specific halacha, you know, law that the Goyim use in Hilchos Yerusha, two parties could, agree to that, to be governed by that, but not the whole body, because the whole body of law would uproot what the Torah says in the entire area of halacha. Minchas Tzvi says something similar but different. He says the problem is not following the secular law per se, but it's mentioning the name of that law. So if you say, I want statute 18, subsection 3, that would be aser. If you want to say, and then you cut and paste all 100 points in statute 18, subsection 3, and you cut and paste it and say, I want to follow these points, but you never mention that it's part of the secular law, that would be okay. Finally, another way that this Rashba is dealt with is that we paskin like this Rashba only with part. We only paskin like this Rashba regarding the halacha that dowries should not be governed by Dina de Machlus Adina, Yerusha is not covered by Dina de Machlus Adina. But in terms of people saying that we want to be accepted by, that we want to accept certain parts of the secular law, that might be okay. Anyway, lots of different ways to understand this Rashba that will yield different ways the Batei Din can possibly borrow one point or a few points from the secular law in a given case. Now, of course, it's important to know, as you as Rabbanim, that when your Baal Batim go to Beis Din, it's not just that they're going to Beis Din and they'll see if they like the Beis Din. I had a case like this. Somebody in my shul last week has said he has somebody, he's a contractor, and somebody wanted to take him to Beis Din, but the fellow who he wanted to take him to Beis Din did not want to sign an arbitration agreement, meaning an agreement that locks them in to whatever this arbitration panel, meaning the Beis Din, will decide. So that's pretty foolish. That means I'll go to Basin with you. If I like what they said and it's in my favor, I'll accept it. If I don't like, well, I didn't sign, I didn't bind myself to it. So I'll just, I don't know, I'll go somewhere else. That's absurd. You have to have a Basin should have an arbitration agreement. So once the two parties agree to be seen by the Basin, they are locked in legally to follow whatever psak the Besdin will paskin. And that will make it a an enforceable contract in American law as well. There is a situation in Eretz Yisrael called Mishpat Tivri. Mishpat Tivri, there are Jewish dayanim in Eretz Yisrael, but the laws are secular. So could we say that the fact that the whole Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael follows not Jewish law, but whatever Israeli law, does that make it up mutter? Absolutely not. All the poskim said pe'echad, from right to left, that the fact that there's a law system does not permit two Jews, just because they live in Israel, to be bound by a secular law system. And therefore, it might even be also to be a judge, maybe even a lawyer in Mishpat Tivri, as we'll develop in a moment. What, there was a suggestion that maybe Mishpat Tivri could be permitted on the following basis. The reason that, which we'll reject momentarily, but the reason why one could argue that maybe Mishpat Tivri would be okay is based on a Rashba. The Rashba says, what happens if you live in a small town in Hicksville, and there are no qualified dayanim, so what do? We appoint three Jewish dayanim based on the concept of Erkaos Shebesuria. Three Jewish dayanim just do the best they can. As long as they do base their decisions on their own common sense, then that's going to be mutter. So not only that, but there's also Meiri that says that these Erkaos Shebesuria who are making their own decisions, not following halacha, but it's still accepted in the absence of other appropriate dayanim. They're even allowed to look at law books. That's what the Meiri says. And based on these two points, we could argue maybe there's room to allow Mishpat Tivri, that's like a situation of Kosha Basuria, and they're finding these law books. But the Achronim point out that that is not a good response. Because first of all, it's only Kosha Basuria permitted only when there are no learned dayanim. And furthermore, it's only when they are doing what the best they can, following their common sense. But if they're bound by a code of law other than the Torah law, that would be usher. That would be, and also if you, Meiri said they could check their law books, doesn't mean they are bound by their law books. And therefore, all the gedolim basically across the board reject the binding application for between two religious Jews of Mishpat Tivri. Next point within this shir. What happens if you want to go to an arbitration board? You are in diamonds and you have a diamond dispute with your fellow Yid, like many people in the diamond exchange. So you don't want to go to court. It's expensive and it's long. You don't want to go to Basin because what do they know about diamonds? You want to go to an diamond arbitrator who knows the way things work in the diamond industry. So are you allowed to do that? So the Rebbe Kvager says that that's okay because they're not doing things based on law per se. They're following minhag hamakal, minhag hasochrim. So therefore, there's no specific kavod to the elilim that is following whatever is the minhag hasochrim. That would be permitted to find an arbitration, to follow an arbitration board, even of non-Jews, in a specific industry. What about going to court and saying we want pshara, we want an arbitration, not don't follow the laws, just arbitrate for us? So there, the Shulchan Aruch says that since you're going to a court, so pshara lefnei kos will indeed be aser. What about stop going to three arbitrators that are Gentile, but they're not part of any court system? So here, you have to look up that Shiloh when it comes up. Okay. Finally, the last part of this shir will be, when is it permitted to go to court? So to this, we have to start with the first most important case is when the nitva, you want to go to Beis Din, but the person you're taking, I want to sue you. You damaged me. But you couldn't care less what the Beis Din says. If you don't come to Beis Din on your own accord, the Beis Din has no force over you in America. So could I force you to go, if you're not coming to Beis Din, could I bring you to court? So here we have two sources in Chazal. Number one, we have a Mishnah in Gittin that says that when it comes to a get, there are certain situations that chov tino, so we have the goyim beat him for omrim lo aseh mash yisrael omer lecha. Certain situation when it's appropriate to be kofa a get, we could employ the hands of the goyish court to help us do what is right. That's one. So again, the Gemara, and another Gemara is a Gemara Bava Kama that says that if you call out to your friend that he doesn't respond, throw a wall against him. And the rest is what it means that you throw a wall against him. It means if you call him to base and he doesn't respond, throw a wall against him or throw him against the wall, meaning take him to court. Now, if you look at both of these sources, as the Chasam Sofer points out, both of these sources are really, you're not just turning to the secular courts. You're really using the courts as a yada arichta of doing what you really wanted the Beis Din to do. And therefore, it's not considered an undermining of the Beis Din. It's asei ma shiyisrael omer lecha. Or here it's, you, the Beis Din can't do what they're going to do, so you're having the court enforce what you would like the Beis Din to do. So that's not going to be considered miyakar shem elilim, miyam betos Moshe. And therefore, the first case where you could take someone to court would be, is if he refuses to go to Beis Din. Next case. Let's say you take someone to, I was taken to court against my will. I didn't want to go to court. I was taken to court. And I lost. So now, can I try to get him to go to Beis Din? Maybe I'll win in Beis Din. So it really depends if when I was dragged to court, I've had this. This happened in my neighborhood not so long ago. Somebody was taken to court and they didn't do so well in court. Now they want to go to Beis Din. So it depends. If you, when you were taken to court, you were kicking and screaming, you tried to get out of it. So it shows you didn't want to be in court. And you can go to Beis Din afterwards. But if you were taken to court, okay, I was taken to court and you hired the best lawyers and you did whatever you can. It sounded like you were working with this model of being in court without a problem, without complaining. So then just because you lost, once you agreed to go to court, you didn't want, you were willing, you were willingly pulled into court willingly. So you have no right to now try, you lost there, try to win somewhere else. That's not going to be okay. A third situation is that you're allowed to go to court is if you know that your opponent will never go to Beis Din. He's a non-religious Jew who, what does he care about what Beis Din says? A seer is meaningless for him. So you're allowed to go to court. Another case is if you're going to court, not because you want an adjudication, but you just want to have something enforced, like the Beis Din gave a psak, but the guy's not paying, so then you could go to the court to enforce something. Similarly, two more things, and with this we'll finish this year. If there's a chov barur, let's say it's absolutely evident, there's no shayla, which is rarely the case, because the guy always has another shayla, but let's say like tuition. The family agreed to pay, you know, $12,000 tuition, and they only paid six, then he's not paying the other six, so there's no two ways about it. Like, you owe the tuition, you sign the contract, you're not paying. So the school should theoretically be able to take you to court because it's a chov barur. But again, oftentimes people have counterclaims that you think it's barur, but the other party doesn't think it's barur. And finally, let's say you just want the court to, you know, freeze assets. Like, I'm going to go to Beis Din shortly, but I don't want him to, you know, steal away the monies from the business in the interim until we get our psak. So you could call, you ask the court for what's called a TRO, a temporary restraining order, an injunction. That would be okay. Those are different scenarios where you're permitted to take somebody to Beis Din. Okay. Next halachas, let's go to Rabbi Schechter's. Any questions about that? About Beis Din and Arkos? Yes, Noam.
Sorry, this is actually just going back to the Chol Moed. I think I just missed just the four leniences: Dav Rabbit, Tzarach Moed, Tzarach Rabim. What was the fourth?
Poel She'elo Mayochal. If somebody is poor enough that he doesn't have enough food for Yontif, so it's mutter for A, for him to work, and B, for you to hire him.
Thank you.
So let's say there's a guy in the neighborhood who does, he's a handyman, and he doesn't really have much money. He doesn't have enough money, to take his kids to Hershey Park and pay the crazy admissions to Hershey Park or Chol Hamoed. Yes, you know, eight kids and $50 each admission, $400. He doesn't have that kind of money. He's it says Polish Inlam Yochal. I don't know if going to Hershey Park with your eight kids is Yochal. But somebody who's financially strapped, A, he's allowed to work to have money to enjoy Yantif, and B, you're allowed to hire him, even though it's a Maisa Uman or something, because Inlam Yochal. Okay. Now let's go to Rav Shechter's shir about wills and inheritance. So number one, we have to be aware of that which we mentioned earlier, that Dina de Machlus Adina does not apply to inheritance. The reason for that, even though there are laws about inheritance, the reason for that is because Dina de Machlus Adina is limited when one of the parties are Gentile. By definition, whenever you have Yerusha case, both parties are going to be Jewish. That's number one. Secondly, there's a Rambam who makes a drasha that we don't really know where he got this from. The Pasuk says, by inheritance, chukas mishpat, that there's an element of chok, that there's an iser v'heter component. It's not just considered mamonis, and therefore you can't make a t'nai, because it's like being masna not to keep kosher. You can't make a t'nai on dvar iser. So therefore, there's no t'nai in the halachas of Yerusha. Obviously, as far as the parameters of Yerusha, the Torah says that only son gets, daughters do not get. A husband inherits a wife does not inherit a husband. So what we normally assume in America and around the world, that if a spouse dies, the other spouse inherits them. For us, it's only a one-way street. The husband will inherit the wife will not inherit the husband. So we're going to have to figure out how to allow the situation to direct the money to where you want it directed in our modern senses of, you know, usually giving to spouse, and if not, if there's no spouse, then give it to all the children equally. We'll talk about that when we get that. So first of all, does the Torah allow a Yerusha, adjusting your Yerusha? Well, the Torah says, b'yom hanchilo es banav, that when you give over to your children, sounds like, says Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch, you're giving something to your children, so it sounds like you could, but there are limitations. The Gemara Bava Basra says, you're only allowed to give bein bein habanim, meaning you're only allowed to give to somebody who is already going to be getting part of the Yerusha. So we already, you know, according to the Torah, the idea of Yerusha only is not going to be for a wife. It's not going to be for daughters. It's going to be to your male sons. The only thing is the Torah allows you to adjust the percentages that you're going to give to your different children. And also the Gemara says it's only if you articulate it in the positive sense. So you could say he'll get 80%, he'll get 20%, as opposed to saying he's not going to get his share of Yerusha, or this son, I have five sons, this son is not going to get his share. I could say positively the other sons will get more, but those are two limitations in this tzava that the Torah does allow. There's a question if this kula that Riochim ben Broka does allow of this mini tzava of sorts, is it limited to only a bari? I'm sorry, is it limited only to a shchivmara or even to a bari? So that's a machlokas, and therefore it's not only that leniency of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka to be manchilas bana based on the pasuk is not going to be so helpful because we don't know if it applies to a bari. Okay, before we talk about other ways to give up Yerushas, how to have a lachik will, which we'll talk about a little bit later, let's talk about the pishnayim that the Bechor gets. Somebody asked me this, Shiloh, about this yesterday. Somebody has a eldest son, wants to know how he should phrase his inheritance. So first of all, the way Pishnayim is calculated is not that the Bechor gets two-thirds, but let's say you have 10 kids, so divide the inheritance up into 11 pieces, the Bechor gets 2/11, and all the others get 1/11. That's halacha number one about what is Pishnayim, and in what properties does a Bechor get Pishnayim? So a Bechor, Bechol Asher Yimatzei Lo, the Torah says, that which is present and available at the time of the father's passing, that which is Muchzak, as opposed to that which is only Ro'i Lavo, that will come later. So for example, if a person dies, leaving over a lottery ticket, since that money of the lottery ticket wasn't around at the moment of death, it will not be given Pishnayim to the Bechor. Now, what about lottery tickets that you win are not so common? What happens if a father lent money while he was alive and he didn't collect it by the moment of death? So this is machlokas tana'im, if that loan is considered muhsak or ra'i. And the Gemara concludes that indeed, since the loan wasn't paid back, it's not muhsak in the hands of the father. And therefore, a halva is considered ra'i. Why is that so important? Maybe the most important point of this year. Because that means that a savings account is I lend the bank so much of my wealth. I have a lot of my money in my savings account. I lent that money to the bank, a CD. I have $500,000 in CDs. That means I lent the bank $500,000. And then I die. I don't have so much cash on hand. How much do I have in my cash account? My savings account I lent to the bank. My checking account is lent to the bank. My CDs are all lent to the bank. So what do I actually have? I have almost nothing. Everything's in the bank I lent to the bank. So that means the father has nothing that's muhsak. The Bechor will not get anything. So here, Indeed, that's exactly the note. Behuda, Adam Schechter holds that when you deposit money in a savings account, that's a havah to the bank, and therefore it's not muhsuk in the hands of the morish when he dies, and therefore it's considered roi, not muhsuk, and there won't be pishnayim. Other achronim, Baruch HaShulchan, Nigris Moshe, disagree and say that if you know you're going to collect it, like, for example, we have an FDIC insured, you know you're going to collect it, so then it's just as good as muhsuk. Meaning, you're right, you did lend it out. But it's not like you lent it out to a guy down the block who may or may not pay you back. You lent it to a bank that's been established for 50 years and has FDIC insurance, and you're going to get your money back. So then, even though practically it's raw, you don't have it now in your hands, but halachically, we look at it as muhsuk because it's just as good as you have collected it. That's what we say regarding pishnai. Now, this discussion of what is the status of a savings account or any money that you have in the bank regarding pishnayim is also going to be applicable for the halacha of does a husband yarshin his wife. Why? Because just like a bechor only gets pishnayim from roi and from muhsuk and not roi, so to a husband, some say, husband is yarshin isto only which that which she has muhsuk and not roi. So let's say wife dies. Let's say a wife has a lot of money from a previous marriage. She has a lot of money. And then she dies. But all of her money is in a savings account. Who's going to inherit that? The husband is only yoresh, that which she has on hand, that which is muhsuk. If we say a savings account is on hand, so the husband will get it. If we say that the savings account is considered roi because she doesn't have it actually right now, then it's going to go to her children. And that is going to depend on the same machlokas that we said earlier between the Noda Behuda and Rav Schechter who say that it's only roi, and therefore it's not muhsuk, there won't be pishnayim on it, on a savings account, and it won't go to her husband, as opposed to the Igros Moshe, who says that the husband, that is considered muhsuk, and the husband will get it, and there will be pishnayim. Fine, let's go to another point now. The halacha, there's a halacha called Lo Tehei Ba'avor Yachsanta. Don't pass off an inheritance, take away an inheritance from somebody. The Gemara tells the story of Yosef ben Yoezer, who wasn't happy with his son. His son didn't become a Talmud Chacham, so he donated all of his wealth to the Beis HaMikdash. Sounds really great, right? No, Chacham were not happy with Yosef ben Yoezer, because they say it's not right. If he's supposed to get a Yerusha, he's supposed to get the Yerusha. Just because he didn't become a Talmud Chacham like you wanted him to, that's not a reason to hold it back from his Yerusha. And Chacham were unhappy with him. However, Moshe says, if you have a kid who's totally, you know, marries out of the tribe, he totally leaves Torah mitzvahs, he hasn't talked to you for 27 years, or crazy agmas nefesh, so then it would be okay to omit him from a will. But other than that, you really shouldn't remove a child from a will. What about leaving money for tzedakah? Could you leave all your wealth for tzedakah so you get more zechuyas? Or should you leave it for your children? So you're not allowed, during your life, you're not allowed to give more than a chumash because you don't want to become poor, but if it's before, as you die, so what's the problem? So this rule still applies, this concept of lote bavor yachsanta. So the question is, how much should you leave for your children even after you give out tzedakah? So there are a number of shitas. One shita says, just leave 4 dinarim for your family. Rav Tukachinsky says, no, you have to leave at least 51% for your yarshem. You can only give 49% to tzedakah. But the Rav Moshe Feinstein says, you have to leave your children a davar chashev for each yorish, get a davar. All the rest, if you have $10 million, you give $9.5 million to tzedakah, and leave $100,000 to each of your 5 kids. $100,000 is probably a davar chashev. They'll each get $100,000. He wrote 1,000 years ago. Maybe now it's 10, 20, 30,000, whatever it is now, for a davar chashev. Everything else you're allowed to give to tzedakah. Okay, now let's talk about how to actually write a will. Theoretically, you shouldn't have to write if you will. After all, mitzvah kayim divrei hames. So the mace tells us what he wants, or he wrote down what he wants. So anytime he writes down what in English is called the last will and testament, mitzvah kayim divrei hames, the children should have to follow. However, Tosa says that that rule of mitzvah kayim divrei hames is limited only if hushlash mitchilas lekach, meaning that those monies were placed in an escrowed or placed in a trust account for a division as however he said he wants it to be divided. So before a person dies, he puts all of his money in a special account. This, you know, he has 4 kids, 25% in this account for that kid, 25% in that account for the other kid, 25% in the account for, and it's hushlash, he specifically put the money there for this division, that would work. But if that's not the case, so you're not going to be have the lenience. You're not going to be able to follow the mitzvah kind of hamei. So we're going to have to find another way. Okay, I have an idea. Why don't we say kibud av va'em? We know that the mitzvah kibud av va'em to honor one's parents even after he dies. Well, that's true. But mitzvah kayim divrei hames, but I'm sorry, but kibud av va'em only applies to your father's money. You don't have to use your money. Once he dies, it's your money now. You don't have to use your money that you inherited from your father to do what your father wanted, like give your sister, for example, give your mother, for example. So how are we going to find a way for a person to leave money for his daughters? We don't have the leniency of mitzvah kind of mace. We don't have kibud av va'em. So what could we do to allow daughters to get their share? So the Rishonim already created a format called shtar chatzi zachar. Because in the olden days, it was thought that if women got half the amount of a zachar, that would be enough. Nowadays, Shlomo Zalman says, no, you should give all your children equally, boys and girls equally. So this is how a shtar chatzi zachar works. It says the following. And again, I had this conversation with somebody just yesterday about his own inheritance in my shul. Somebody, you know, just going through this stuff. It works like this. Let's say you have a daughter. You have five boys and one girl. Just make life easier. Five boys and one girl. You say your daughter should not get a penny. You have ten. Let's say you're going to have $10 million when you die, hopefully. Sounds good. So you're going to have $5 million. Each of the boys should get $2 million. Well, really, the Bechor is going to get a little more. He'll get, I can't do the math, divide a million into six parts, and he'll get 2/6. Everyone will get 1/6. Okay. So everybody else will get 1.8 million. He'll get like 3.6 million, something like that. I don't know exactly, a little less. You don't want him to get extra. You don't want your daughter to be left out. So what you're going to do is you're going to go over to your daughter and say, sweetheart, I am hereby mischayev to you from right this second, $10 million. $10 million. It's hers right now. But that's going to be really bad for the Yorshim. You know why? Because when I die, what's going to be left for the boys? Absolutely nothing. So the girl gets everything, but that's not fair to the boys. So what I'm also going to do is I'm going to add a line. I'm going to say, but my dear boys, if you are willing, and I tell this to my Bechor, I know halachically you're supposed to get double, Pishnaim, but if you, Mr. Bechor, and the rest of my boys are willing to share the wealth that I'm leaving behind me, the way I outlined in my last will and testament that every one of you should get equal and equal share, then I am hereby mochel that hishtabdus, that shibud, that hischaivus that I made to my daughter. So, my dear sons, you have a choice. You could either not follow my directions, in which case my daughter gets all $10 million, you get nothing. Or you could follow my directions, in which case I will therefore be mochel my chiyuv to my daughter of the $10 million, and you'll follow, and you'll just follow my directions. And that's the way to get out of the din of Bechor, and that's the way to get out of leaving, the daughters or the wife losing out. The way this is done, the problem is you don't want to say that I'm going to give, you might have wanted to say, I'm going to give this present to my daughter a moment before I die, right? Because if I give my daughter the $10 million right now, then how am I going to buy myself, how am I going to pay rent next month? So it would have been better to say, I'm going to be mischayev to my daughter a minute before I die. The problem is that's brera. I don't know when I'm going to die. So therefore, we hold in brera. So therefore, what I'm going to do is I'm going to be mischayev myself right now and only allow zechus gevia a moment before death, because there's only brera on the ikar hadavar, not on a side point. The ikar hadavar, the schaivas, then we would say in brera, and that can't be chalma before death because that's an unspecified time. So I'll do be mischayev myself right now to my daughter. And the zechus gevia, which is tangential to the chiyuv, it's just collecting it, that will be a moment before death. So she'll have the zechus gevia a moment before death, before my children inherit anything. And therefore, my boys better follow my last will and testament. Otherwise, when I die, she will have had the chischaivas mechaim and the zechus gevia a moment before death, and everything will go to her. So if they want to get any, my boys want to get anything, they better follow what the doctor ordered, what the father said. Okay, that is. Any questions about the shiur and the wills and estates?
Yes, sir. What was that phrase they used by the story of Yossi ben Yoezer?
Lo tehei ba'avor yachsanta. You shouldn't pass on an inheritance that is due somebody. Lo tehei ba'avor yachsanta. If somebody's supposed to inherit, you shouldn't take it away from them and let them, you know, give it to somebody else or disinherit somebody or give it all to tzedakah and the children won't get what they rightfully, you know, expect. Okay.
Thank you.
Let's talk now about Dina de Machusa Dina. All right, Shach to Shri on Dina de Machusa Dina. Okay, so first of all, what is the source for the concept of Dina de Machusa Dina? So we're going to have a few sources. Number one, the Ber HaGrad Meiri say it's based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, where Bnei Yisrael asked for a Melech, and there's Machlokas what the Psukim mean when they asked for a Melech, and Shmuel HaNavi warned them, you better be careful, a Melech could do all kinds of things, he could levy taxes. Was that the Gemara's way of saying that, was that Shmuel HaNavi's way of saying, just scaring them, or is it saying that these are indeed the rights that a Melech has? The Shulchan Aruch seems to paskin that whatever Shmuel HaNavi scared Bnei Israel about the powers of a king are indeed the authority of the king. And therefore, based on those Pesukim and Shmuel, we see that a king or a government has the right to levy tax. And if that would be the case, it would be certainly in Eretz Israel, because that's what Shmuel HaNavi was. So the Shulchan Aruch passes this way, which sounds like there should be taxes in Eretz Israel. You should be bound by taxes in Eretz Israel. There's a famous Ran in the Nedarim who says, no, there's a different reason why a government could apply taxes. It's because of the king who owns the land has the right to rent the land that he owns to whoever lives in his land. And that's the case, then there should not be taxation in Eretz Israel, because every Jew has a right to live in Eretz Israel. It's not the king's decision to let me live in Eretz Israel. I'm a Jew. I have the right to have the Maidan Arabs in Eretz Israel. According to that Ran, you should not necessarily be bound by paying taxes in Eretz Israel, because I also have a right. You can't rent it to me if I have a right to be there. As Rabbi Shechter points out, even though people like to quote this Ran to say you don't have to pay taxes in Eretz Israel, this Ran does not make it into the Shulchan Aruch. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch paskins otherwise, and it's not cited in the post in the Shulchan Aruch, not even brought in the Ezra Yesh Omrim, neither the Shulchan Aruch, nor the Ramah. So that is a second possibility why you have to, why there's a heter to charge taxes. A third possibility of why you charge tax, how government could charge taxes, is Rav Schechter's suggestion, which is very creative, and Rav Schechter goes with this. And that is that it's not a halacha in Hilchas Dina D'machus Dina, it's a halacha in Hilchas Shutfin. The halachas of Shutfin are that people who are Shutfin in something are bound by the Shutfus. Even if a decision is made by the Shutfin, we follow the majority of the Shutfin's decision, and the minority is bound and swept along with them. So, and that's first of all. Second of all, you could be bound into a Shutfus even because of your circumstance. Even though you never made a formal agreement to be bound together, the very fact that you're living in the same community, that might bind you itself. And therefore, if you put those two things together, we all live in the same village, town, county, borough, city, state, country, whatever the level of municipality we want to talk about is. So therefore, that binds us together as Shutfin, and therefore the majority, otherwise known as whatever we vote, whatever our representation decides as the government, as a democratic government, that would make us Shutfin, and we're bound to follow the laws of that Shutfin, which in this case would be paying taxes like anything else. So even if I myself don't want to pay public school taxes because my kids go to great yeshivas, nevertheless, I'm joined as a Shutuf to the state in which I live, and I have to pay taxes because I, as the miut, am bound to the decisions of the rov who voted that they should be taxes for an educational system. So in other words, the point of the taxes are shutfus, not because of the king's rights, not because of Dina L'Machus Adina, but because of Hilchus Shutfin. That's Reb Schechter's suggestion. Now, what are the parameters? What are the applications of Dina D'Machus Adina? So the Dvar Avram says there are four applications of Dina D'Machus Adina. Number one, which is one of the things we mentioned, the ability to charge taxes. Excuse me. Number two, to define what is Kesef, as we'll see, kesef has to be defined for to be considered kesef for ma'aser sheni, for pidyon ma'aser sheni, etc. Dina mechus dina has the ability to cause to be ma'anish, to punish, and to create a legal system. We'll talk about some of those things a little bit later. If you want to be Nitui Kartanik and reject the Zionist regime, so that means when you're going to be eating your tomatoes or your apples that happen to grow somewhere in Eretz Israel, and you're going to have to be poda the Kedushas Ma'aser Sheni and put it on a coin, if you hold that the Zionist regime does not have the authority to be a government and establish laws, including minting coins, you should not be able to use a shekel to be poda your Ma'aser Sheni. So anybody in Eretz Israel who uses a coin to be poda Ma'aser Sheni, which is just about 99% of the country, including the Haredim, that means they agree, they assume that the government is a government, and therefore has the right to mint coins, and therefore theoretically that's because of Dina Machus Dina. Coins are also important to be defined by a government, because that defines for Hilchis Ribis, that's it's considered Tiva, not Peira, for those of you who are holding above Mitzia and Hilchis Ribis, but that's not for now. Okay, we spoke about Dina Machus Dina, that Dina Machus Dina only applies when you have two Jewish parties. I'm sorry, I take that back. Only if you have one Gentile party. But if you have two Jewish parties who are sparring, fighting with another, then of course we follow Torah law and not Dina Machus Dina. So therefore we said in the previous share, Yerusha, of course, will always be based on Halacha, not on Dina Machus Dina. There are some situations where Dina Machus Dina can apply even between two Jews. Rav Henkin writes that whenever there's a governmental decree that is Latikun HaMedina, then a Dina Machus Dina will apply even between Jews. So for what's an example of something that's Tikun HaMedina? Rent control, landlord is Jewish, tenant is Jewish, even though they should follow what the Shulchan Aruch says about rental. Nevertheless, rent control is Latikun HaMedina, therefore they would be bound by the Dina Machus Dina. Minimum wage, just because you're Jewish, I can't charge you less than minimum wage because it's Latikun HaMedina. Bankruptcy might also be included in this. Bankruptcy was created by the government of Tikkun HaMedina to help the economy flow and flourish. Another situation, the Shacha adds two other situations where there are exceptions where we would also apply Dina de Machus Adin even between two Jews. Says the Shach, if the halacha is silent about a certain area of dispute between two Jews, if there is no halacha regarding this issue, then we'll follow Dina de Machus Adina. Comes the Chazon Ish and says, there's no such thing as no halacha applying in a certain case. If you don't know what the halacha is, so then we'll just say, follow the Machzak. If there's no such thing as a case, you're the chayav, halacha says you're the chayav of pater. If you're not chayav, then you're pater. Of course, there's no such thing as a case without a halacha. So the Chazon Ish rejects that point. And the Shach suggests another situation. Let's say you have a store, and there are certain laws about return policy, for example. Let's say the New York State requires a 7-day return policy, 30-day return policy with receipt, without receipt. But according to halacha, that might not be exactly the case. So you're going to say, oh, all the Jews who walk into my store, they'll follow halacha. All the goyim will follow what the state says, because the halacha is dina between me and a guy. So the Shach says, no, you can't do that. The fact that he comes into, you're not going to be able to ask every customer, are you Jewish, you're not Jewish. The fact that he walked into my store, there's an umdina, there's a minhag medina, and it's assumed that you're walking into my store based on what is normal. So similarly, like working 9 to 5, even though the Shulchan Aruch says that a poel is supposed to work from alos hashachar until tzeis hakochavim, let's say I didn't arrange the exact times with my employee. I hire him for a day, and he comes at 9, he leaves at 5, and he wants me to pay him. I say, no way, I'm not paying you. I told you, I'll give you $100 if you work for the day. I meant the day according to Torah law, which is from Alos HaShachar till Tzeis HaKochavim. So he could say, no, this is the Minhag HaMedina, and therefore we would follow, it's assumed that you're going to operate with Minhag HaMedina. And that would be Ki'ilu Hisne, and we will allow Dina Machus Adina to be there. Okay. Let's now move to another aspect of the Shia, which is the parameters of Mesira. When it comes to Mesira, the Gemara in... We know that the Beis Din has the ability to be makin ve'onjin shlomen hadin. And this ability to be makin ve'on umanish shlomen hadin, even more than Torah theoretically allows, might even apply to non-Jewish governments. As the Rishonim proved from a Gemara Bava Metzia. Gemara Bava Metzia talks about Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's son, who was hired by the Roman government to find Jewish criminals, even though they used to give a death penalty to the Jewish, to robbers. That means that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's son was working for the Romans to give death penalties for Gneva. That's what the Gemara says. So you see, and the Gemara says that Eliyahu HaNavi said, why are you doing this? And he said, I'm getting rid of the, you know, the coats and the bad Jews. Eliyahu HaNavi says, let Hashem take care of it. That's not your job. Which sounds like it's not usher. It's just not a nice job for a good Jewish boy. So that's what the Rishonim say. The Rishonim say that to do this, to hand over a Jew to the secular government, even if the secular government is going to do something worse, seems to be mutter, which is not a proper thing. So that's not considered Mesira. What's Mesira? Mesira is when a Mesira would be when nothing should be turned over. The person didn't do anything wrong and you turn them to the government. The person did something wrong and you turn them to the government, even if the government's going to have a worse punishment than what Torah allows, that's permitted. That's not considered Mesira. As long as you violated a criminal offense. This is Rav Schechter's big sheet about Mesira. And therefore, you are permitted to inform the authorities against another Jew, even if the Jew will be punished, as long as there is something wrong, some violation of halacha that the Jew did. And even if the government will punish more than what Torah allows. When is there a mesira that's not permitted? When he would end up being punished more than what even the government says. Let's say the government says he should be in jail for 2 years. And you know that the judges are anti-Semitic and would put a Jew in jail for 3 years, even though it should only be for 2 years, that would be Mesira. Then he wouldn't be able to turn somebody in. Okay, but otherwise, Rav Schechter's opinion is you're allowed to turn a Jew in, even if he'll be thrown in prison, even if throwing in prison is worse than what the Torah law would require. Rabosai, I think it's very important for you to know that even though that's what Rav Schechter said in the Shir, and that's Rav Schechter's position, Rav Moshe and many other Bati Din do not follow that. Rav Moshe says explicitly in Aruch Chaim Chelek Hei Siman Tes that you're not permitted to turn a Jew in if the punishment of the government would be more than what we do. So, for example, if there's something that a Jew does that we would say he's chayv to pay money, and the government would say you go to jail, Rav Moshe says you're not allowed to be moser that you turn that person into the authorities, and therefore a thief, you're not allowed to turn a thief into the authorities. Oh, what about the case that Rav Schechter drew a proof from, that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's son did turn people into the Romans, even though they were going to be killed, which is definitely more than what Jewish law allows? Rav Moshe says, no, that's because he was appointed by them. If you're appointed by the Malchus, then you're allowed to do your job, even if it's more, and turn Jews in, even if it's more than what the Torah says. But if you're not appointed by the government, you're not allowed to do more than, to turn somebody in, to call the police, if they would be punished, like going to jail, more than what would happen up halacha, where they wouldn't be thrown to jail. So that Rav Moshe is against what Rav Schechter said in the Shir. It's important for you to know that. Okay, let's continue in the Shir. Rav Schechter also points out that even if a Jew doesn't want to testify about another Jew, if it's going to cause a chil Hashem, then we don't say that there's an Isra Mesira. Let's say there would be an Isra Mesira if you would testify in a court case, because they would do who knows what to the Jew. But they know that you're not testifying because you're Jewish, because you don't want to tell on a fellow Jew. That would be a Chil Hashem. So there, you don't have an Isra Mesira. And there, even if the Jew would end up being punished more than what should really happen, and even Rav Schechter would say, you're not allowed to turn such a person in, but if it's going to cause a chil Hashem, then the Shulchan Aruch says you are allowed to. You would be permitted to turn the person in. When the Shulchan Aruch speaks about Mesira, it does say that two cases are Mesira is permitted, meaning even if it's going to be worse than the government rules, that the guy's going to go to jail and he's going to get beaten up in jail, right? The law is that you go to jail for 2 years. But you and I know that he's going to go to jail, he's going to get beaten up. That's Mesira, it's also to do. But in the following two kinds, it's mutter. Number one is that somebody who's Meitzer is Harabim, So an example of somebody who calls it tzar to the Rambam would be a pedophile, a ganav, an abuser, a con artist. There you could send him, even if he's going to go to jail and get beat up in jail, you're still allowed to. Ponzi scheme situation. And number two is maka es chavero. Maka es chavero, you're allowed to be moster on him, even if he, again, will be punished more than what he should be. Okay, that's the end of that shir. Any questions about that shir?
Okay. One question. The remorse you quoted before, was he saying that Rabbi Elazar bar Rabbi Shimon was forced to be a government official, or did he elect to become a government official?
I assume the Roman government wanted him to do it. I can't imagine the government said, would you like to? The government said, we know that you know the Jews, you'll probably do a good job. I don't know.
Because, I mean, Lechor, according to his Sfar, it would be usher to become a government official if you're going to be turning people in and they're going to get punished.
I like you, Sfar. I don't know if you're right. You could be right. I don't know. Okay. Maybe we'll do one or two more shiurim. It's already getting late. Let's talk about Rabbi Sabalowski's shiur about child care on Shabbos. So he covered a lot of different topics. Number one, nursing. We have to know that pumping milk is an possible issa daraisa of disha. However, if a woman is in pain, so if we can knock this down to an issa darabanan, maybe we could be mekel for an issa darabanan b'makom tsar. How do you knock down an issa daraisa of disha to allow a woman to express her milk? So if you are cholev le'ibud, let the milk go to waste, that would be pasul malach shem tzrich le'gufa and only darabanan. Or it's going to be not derech disha and only drabanan. Maybe it's not, if it's not the tzorch, it's not considered disha, and therefore you knocked it down to din drabanan. Once it's knocked down to drabanan, we could say if the woman is in pain, she feels like she's exploding, then it will be permitted for her to express the milk in a way that it goes le'ibud. How does it have to go le'ibud? It should go into, you know, the pumps have a little can, and if you put some detergent, some palm olive on the bottom of that can, it goes straight into the soap, the dishwashing soap, so then that milk will have gone l'ibud, and b'makom tzarech, if a woman's in pain, she would be permitted to express her milk that way, but there's no way, and I get this shaila a few times a year from new mothers who want to, you know, pump their milk, especially at the beginning when there's colostrum, which is very healthy for the baby. There's no heter to pump milk on Shabbos and keep the milk. There's only a heter to pump milk if you will not keep the milk and you're in pain. Obviously, if there's a pikuach nefesh for the baby, that's a different situation. Now, if you have a... okay. When it comes to warming up the milk, you have to realize that the mother's milk is not mevushel. So there's going to be a problem of bishul if you warm it up in a cup of in hot water. So there's two ways you could warm up the milk. If you take milk out of the fridge or the freezer to warm up for the baby, either put it, the bottle of milk or the bag of milk, in a cup of water such that it cannot eat the interior milk. The milk cannot reach Yatzeladis Bo. Well, you don't want to burn your baby's mouth, so that would make sense. Alternatively, Ramosha holds that there's no such thing as a klishlishi. Even though klisheni maybe is mevashel, klishlishi is definitely not mevashel. So if you hold from that Ramosha against Mishnah Berurah, Mishabrua is machmir that maybe klishlishi is mevashel, but according to Ramosha's kula, that you're allowed to use a klishlishi, so then you could put the milk, even though it's never mevushel, and there is a problem of bishel, you could put it into klishlishi where there is no problem of bishel. Obviously, all the cow milk that we use is all pasteurized, all the formula that we use is all cooked previously, and there would be ein bishel achar bishel, and therefore you'd be able to use that in a klisheni, to warm that up with a klisheni. Okay. Let's talk about making baby cereal or oatmeal. The issue here is a potential issue derisa of lisha, of making a dough, of making a batter. So here, to permit this for the child, because remember, they start eating, these are their first foods. They don't eat other foods yet. So you have to give them food, and this is the only food that they eat. So what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to knock this issue derisa of lisha down to a drabanan, and then also make it mutton. So how are we going to knock it down to the rabbanon? So lisha da'araisa only applies if you have belila ava, like a dough, like a challah dough, like a cookie dough. However, belila raka, which is like a batter, like a pancake batter, or a liquidy cake batter, that would be only lisha da'araisa. That's number one. So if you do that, you knock it down to the rabbanon. Secondly, if you could do a shinui in that lisha, then you can make this a shinui on a drabanan, maybe make a mutter in a case of tzara. How do you do a shinui? Well, we have to define what is the moment of lisha. What is the moment, the shas gibul? Is it when you pour the water into the flour? Is that the moment of lisha? Or is the moment of lisha when you do the kneading with a K, the kneading of the dough? Is that the moment of lisha? So we're not sure. So therefore, we're going to have to do a shinui in both of those moments. If the moment of lisha, the shas iser, is in a siyas hamayim, we'll have to do a shinui at in the siyas hamayim. So for example, if normally you put in the flour, I mean the baby cereal, the oatmeal, then you pour water. On Shabbos, you'll pour water, a lot of it, because you want to make it a blila raka, so it's not a sederaisa. And then you'll put the oatmeal on top of the water. You'll do the opposite direction. If indeed that isn't the Sha'as Gibel, the moment of Isser, rather the moment of Isser is when you're actually doing the kneading, so we'll do the mixing with the shinui. For example, instead of using a spoon, I'll use my finger. Instead of doing a circle, I'll do an X, lift my finger out, do an X, lift my finger out, another line, lift my finger out. I'll do shinuyim with a weird way of mixing. I'll do a shinui by changing the direction of the water. And thirdly, I will make sure to have a blila raka. Now this is going to be permitted only b'shas etzorach, like the baby doesn't have other food, but if there's not a shas etzorach, you should avoid this, and that's why we don't make oatmeal on Shabbos for ourselves, because this is relying on some leniencies. Next point is, what about tochein, chopping up the vegetables of the chicken? So we know that tochein is daraisa on gidulei karka. So there's nothing wrong with chopping up chicken or chopping up eggs. Making egg salad could be a problem of lush, but putting that aside, chopping up eggs, mashing tuna fish, mashing eggs, chopping up chicken to small pieces is totally fine. It's not gidulei karka. But if you have vegetables, that is going to be tochein. So how do you do that? So you should cut it not too small. How big is too small? Well, the Yireim said, the Yireim says, we don't know what too small is. So that's not such a kula. Another heter is the following. When it comes to borer, we know that if borer is done immediately before the suda, that's called derech achila, not derech malacha, and that would be permitted. So the Rashba says, just like we have a din of la'alter by borer, we should take that concept of borer la'alter that makes a mutter and apply it to tochein la'alter. Therefore, according to the Rashba, if you're going to do your chopping of the salad, your chopping of your vegetables immediately before the meal, whatever amount of time you normally need to prepare the meal, a half hour, 40 minutes, whatever amount of time you usually use to prepare your meal, that would be permitted to chop vegetables. The problem is, the Achronim are not so sure that we could apply the kula of borer, of the kula of la'alter that we have by borer to a tochen as well. And therefore, the Mishnah Berurah suggests you should do two things. You should do some to the meal, and also don't chop your pieces so small, let them be a little bigger than regular. If you have larger pieces and it's adjacent to your meal, then you have a double kula, and then you could, that's the way you would chop your vegetables. What about mushing a banana or mushing an avocado? So the Chazon Ish has a very big chumrah, a triple chumrah. He says that's so dumya to the real tochein, which is grinding flour, where it's like you're grinding into, it's like the real tochein. You're not just cutting up, chopping into little pieces. Your mom's being tochein it, completely pulverizing it. That would be worse than cutting vegetables. That does not have the kula of the Rashba, and therefore you do not have any kula to mash a banana, even right before a meal, and therefore mashing a banana or mashing an avocado would be an iser d'oraisa on Shabbos. But, says the Chazon Ish, if you do it kila'achayad, like the back of a spoon, it's mutter gamer. So there are a number of confusing things about this shita. Number one, this should be tochein. Tochein means you're taking a grain and you're crushing it into pieces. When you take a banana or avocado, you're not taking one piece and crushing it into many small pieces. You're taking a big avocado and you're reshaping it into a shmush avocado, or a banana that's shaped like this, and you're shmushing it into a different shape. That shouldn't be, like the tochein of, like real tochein, which is grinding. Number two, when something is asa d'oraisa, so if you do kala achayah, that's going to make it mutter. No, it just knocks down to be d'rabbanan. It should still be asa. So nevertheless, so Rav Moshe said, I don't understand why mashing bananas. Mashing bananas and avocados should not even be asa at all. It should be mutter entirely l'chatchila. because it's not telchein, it's not taking a chayfetz and grinding to powder or to little pieces, it's just mushing it. And therefore, it should not be usher at all. However, since the chazanish was machmir, it will be machmir, but he gives a kula. I don't understand the kula, but if he says that this kula that he would do it, kalachayad, we'll take that heter kalachayad. That's Ramosha's willing to take the kula of the chazanish. When it comes to diaper changing, there's, of course, the machlokas regarding wipes. Is wipes considered squeezing liquid out of the wipe, or is it just the water on the outside surface of the liquid is cleaning the baby's feel? Machlokas in Metzius a little bit. Another issue is diapers. Two issues. First of all, Korea, when you undo the tabs or unglue the tabs. And then there's Topher when you attach it on the baby. And then again, Topher, when you finish with a dirty diaper, you want to close it up and put the tabs on before you throw it out. That's also a malach of Topher. So first of all, it's important to realize that Velcro, if you look at it closely, it really just hooks and eyes. It's not really, it's not Topher. It's not glue. So those brands that use Velcro type adhesives are mutter. Those that use adhesive type tabs, like glue, that would talk and be the problem. But maybe we could argue it's not Topher Shel Kayama because you are just putting it on the baby for a few hours. That's true. But then when you throw it out, that would be a Topher Shel Kayama. Others say that even when you throw it out, it's something that you don't care about when you throw it out. Just like when you tied the knot on the Sir Lazazel, the red string, and you threw him over the cliff, you don't care about that, even though you did tie that. Excuse me. You tie the knot, but then you don't care about it because you're about to throw it out, so maybe that's not considered Topher Shel Kayama. That's a good Shaila. If you can open your diapers before Shabbos, that's great. If when you throw it out, you leave it not adhesived when you put it in the garbage, that's only a sign to be machmir for. When it comes to putting ointments on a baby's bottom, so there, all children who are in pain or not or crying are considered a chola she'ein bo sakana, and therefore we could do something kilacha yad. So therefore, we'll flop the stuff on the baby's bottom without rubbing it around, which would be mamachek. We just plop it on, and that would be like the kilacha yad, which we could do for the baby. If a child's not walking and there's no Erev, so the best thing is to bribe them, offer them a lollipop. If you can't do that, you have to get a guy, and we'll have to rely on Shvista Shvus Makam Mitzvah, B'makam Chola, B'makam Tzar Tzar, and you'll have an Amir Lenachri to carry in a Carmelist. That's a double, it's a Drabanan, if indeed, you know, getting the kid, you know, not having to stay in the streets for the rest of Shabbos would certainly be Makam Tzar. If that's not an option, so then you could try to do Pachos Pachos, Midal and Amis, but that's already should be avoided. When it comes to illnesses or a baby who's sick, so again, he has always had any child who's in that situation is always considered chol she'ein bo sakana. And if you need to, you might even be able to turn on an electricity with a shinui if necessary for a chola, even though she'ein bo sakana, if he needs a nebulizer, for example. Okay. Let's just see. Just a quick overview of the... Any questions on what we just did on Shabbos for kids?
Yeah, so a quick question. Why is nursing permitted but pumping the milk forbidden?
Great question. I don't have a good answer for you. They all ask your question.
What was that?
They all ask you a question. I don't remember the answer. They all ask you a question. That's the number one question in Disha. Why is a baby allowed to nurse? It should be Nisa Daraisa. I don't remember what the answer. Okay, so talking about Rabbi Dr. Affel's shir about physicians on Shabbos, basically, we're not going to go through the whole shir, just 2 points. You'll go through the details yourselves. Point number one is a fundamental machlokas from Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman. The Rambam tells us that Shabbos is dechuya eitzel pikoach nefesh. If we take it literally, that really means it's dechuya, not hutra. So that means you have to be careful with what you're doing for pikoach nefesh on Shabbos. The problem is that we have explicit gemaras that say, and the Rambam himself paskins, that you're supposed to not do it with a katan, not do it with an isha, do it yourself. The gadol, the talmud chacham, should do it himself. I thought if it's dechuya, you should look for a katan to do it. So the way Moshe answers the stira is the following. Moshe says that practically, when you're dealing with pikuach nefesh, you do everything the same. What dechuya means is that you shouldn't put yourself in a situation where you will need to be do pikuach nefesh. Therefore, Ramosha assumes that avoiding being, once you're in a pikuach nefesh situation, do whatever you got to do regularly. However, don't let yourself be in the situation in the first place. So basically, try to avoid being on shift. If you have, if you put on shift, you should get out of the shift. You should trade it with a Gentile. If you have to trade with a Jew, a non-religious Jew, trade it with a non-religious Jew. Oh, what do you mean? But it's lifnei iver. No, it's not. It's not so bad, because at least you're allowing him, the non-religious Jew, to do pikuach nefesh activities, and instead of, you know, just barbecuing in his backyard on a random Saturday afternoon. Rav Shlomo Zalman takes issue with that on 2 points. First of all, on the last point, Rav Shlomo Zalman says maybe you have to have kavana for pikuach nefesh when you are through the pikuach nefesh. So if the Jew, when he works in the hospital, he might not be doing his kavana might not be pikuach nefesh. He's going to work, so you might not have that. It's not that he's doing less lifnei iver, he's doing pikuach nefesh activities. Shlomo Zalman says we look at not just the mice that he's doing of saving life, we look at his das, his kavana. Secondly, Shlomo Zalman would argue on that first point is because of Shlomo Zalman says that adarabba, because pikuach nefesh is a mitzvah gedola, you're not supposed to avoid being in the situation of pikuach nefesh. What is this all based on? This is all based on the longer sugya, which we're not going to go through now, but you should go through for the exam of mafligim besfina, a mafligim besfina. Before Shabbos, is that according to the Baal HaMor, the problem is a problem of Chil Shabbos. That if you get on the three shitas, of course, why in Mafliga B'Sfina Toch Gimel Yamim? One is because of Oneg Shabbos, one is because I don't remember Oneg Shabbos.
Tchumim.
Tchumim. Thank you. Tchum. And the third opinion is that you'll do, you might end up doing malacha if you have to tie knots and save the boat, you know, do whatever you have to do. According to the Baal HaMor, says that third opinion, then this is a ripe example. This sugya of Ein Mafligim B'Sfina is a ripe example of a situation where you're putting yourself into a situation where you will have to be do pikuach nefesh. You're getting on a boat knowing that you're going to have to be mechal Shabbos to save yourself once you're on that boat. So that would apply to a situation of being on call, allowing yourself to be in the hospital. Once you're in the hospital, you have the heter of pikuach nefesh. What does that mean? Pikuach nefesh to save all the Jews. And if there are Gentiles there, you're going to have to save them and be mechal Shabbos derais, because if you don't, then like the Chasam Sofer says, they might kill you. Or like Ramosha extends a little bit more, word will get out that Jews are not treating the goyim properly and appropriately and responsibly in the hospitals, and the goyim won't treat us properly, God forbid. And therefore, it's pikuach nefesh not just to the doctor, but to Klal Yisrael. And that's the heter that we have to treat Gentiles on Shabbos. But you're putting yourself into that situation. So Moshe would say, avoid being in that situation. Rav Shlomo Zalman would say, it's totally fine to be in that situation. So this is just, you know, one point or two from these two shurim. And I'll encourage you, you have to see the rest of these shurim inside. Our time is up, so we'll stop here.